Hello, welcome to another of our Future Pharmacist conference sessions. Amazing friend and colleague on the line today. Where are you beaming in from today, Catherine, by the way?
Today, Jonathan, I'm beaming in from London in the United Kingdom, which has been my main base since March 2020, with a couple of forays into The Hague every now and then.
Excellent. So of course, a very well-known pharmacy face. We've got the Chief Executive Officer of the International Pharmaceutical Federation, to give you your full title, Dr. Duggan. And yeah, lovely to have you here. And yeah, just looking forward to having, you know, adding to some of the really interesting interviews and talks we've had on the conference, but specifically hoping to get a global perspective, shall we say. So, I mean, life is a bit tough at the minute, Catherine, right? So I don't see it many folk in the market, I shouldn't say market, I mean, in pharmacy, painting a rosy picture. There are pockets of, you know, we love a pilot, we love an early adopter, and then the early adopters go and, you know, win awards, which most of them nominate themselves for, you know. So and so we go in this virtuous cycle. But could you draw back from that and give me, like, present a vision for the future and give me some positivity today?
Oh, Jonathan, I know, you know, we've all got ahead of us the concept of coming out of this pandemic, but there's something to be said for taking a pause and understanding just how impactful these past 19, 20 months have been on all of us. And the fact that while we're supposed to be having a spring in our step, most of us are finding it a bit of a trudge at the moment. But the thing is, Jonathan, that the pandemic for our profession has afforded us one of the biggest PR opportunities ever. And I would say that's been a global phenomenon. All of the lights on every high street and all communities went off globally, except for the community pharmacy. And within that, the workforce of that community pharmacy and the pharmacists within it. And of course, the same was in the hospital sector and the industrial sector, and our pharmaceutical scientists and then our educators stayed open, so to speak. So our profession stepped up and stepped in and really didn't even think of that. The sleeves were rolled up right at the outset. The community pharmacists globally invested in their businesses without any concept of return on investment because it was the right thing to do. At the very start of the pandemic, we just really didn't hear health ministers talking about pharmacy. They would talk about health workforce, they talk about doctors and nurses, but they didn't mention pharmacy. And because the pharmacists were doing the job day to day and the public could see that, we were able as a global body to just shine a light on that and to agitate health ministers in all the countries, in all the regions, to notice pharmacy. And then if you chart back, and we're going to do a big piece of work, we're in the middle of a big piece of work, Jonathan, to chart each 100 days from 30th of January 2020. And we're going to chart that for 1,000 days. So that'll take us to around the fourth anniversary of the Astana Declaration, which will be October next year. Because this is not an acute crisis, this is a long-term chronic pandemic. And that's what we all need to realise. We're charting the impact of what pharmacists did in each country, in each of the six WHO regions, each 100 days. So we don't look and see where we could do it better next time, although that will be a lesson that emerges. We showcase the adaptability and the flexibility of the profession. Why do I say that, Jonathan? Because prior to the pandemic, big issues for pharmacy were around shortages, supply chain, safety, perhaps falsified medicines, the competency of the workforce. In every single one of our countries, it would be about we're not necessarily recognised, we're not necessarily known about, where we have to really agitate to be heard. Now, the pandemic has put us at the top table. We've got a big meeting with WHO around the year of the health worker in middle of October, end of October. And that is somewhere where we're saying you have to explicitly mention pharmacy in all of the workforce documentation. You have to, because it's the right thing to do. Not because we have an MOU with WHO, but because it's the right thing to do. And then, Jonathan, to be visionary, when you're very tired and exhausted and you've had 20 months of a pandemic on top of years of disinvestment in the sector that you work in, whether that's hospital, community, academia, science, and you're being asked to do more with less. What you need is a sense of value and a sense of purpose. So as an individual, you can get up with a bit of vim in your step and you can demonstrate to yourself that the job you're doing is worth it. Now, not only does that need paying, but it also needs some kind of professional, what I would call a golden thread. So what we're seeking to do is to create a roadmap for the profession globally that aligns with the Sustainable Development Goals, that ensures that all global agencies know the place of our profession. And then each country can adapt that for its own use. But each pharmacist can almost hold true to the fact that we are delivering against what the globe needs us to on our own high streets, in our own communities. And I'm happy to go into detail about that, Jonathan, but someone somewhere needs to kind of paint a picture of the road ahead that we can all kind of travel along together. Maybe we take different routes, maybe we're at different speeds, but everybody needs to feel like they're coming out of this with a better sense of what's important.
I do think it's very helpful for someone in your position to recognize on behalf of, you know, jobbing pharmacists that there has been disinvestment over the years and money, you know, I am generalizing, but money, and I'm not so familiar with the global picture. I'm speaking more about the UK where I understand it a bit better. Money has quietly trickled out the back door of our profession for decades. So all I was going to say was for someone in your position to recognise that, I think is amazing, actually, and it gives us a starting point. As for the future, really interesting insights. I think, like, you personally are a tremendous leader, and, you know, I'm as cynical as they come about leadership, but, you know, when you listen to someone, like, you were just speaking there, and I just felt like, you know, I think people watching will probably just feel as well, gosh, I want to be involved in that. I want to move forward with that. It's not a dangerous revolution. It's like a progressive agenda that it feels like you're sort of pointing to. And I want to ask you, there's loads of stuff, but I want to ask you a little bit about, like, your WHO, the World Health Organization work, and the Astana Declaration as well. I think one of your personal talents, Catherine, and I know other, many others agree, is you can get into, for some reason, you can get pharmacy into places where they've never been. And once you're in and they see what pharmacy can do, it can be quite exciting. And I think since you've been at FIP, you've really shown that as well. So for the benefit of again, the jobbing pharmacist, what does your relationship with the World Health Organization look like? And, you know, in this Astana declaration, basically, what does that all mean to Joe Bloggs on the ground?
So, Jonathan, I've got three main points to cover now, and I'll come to the Astana declaration in a couple of minutes. But what you hear from, let's say, jobbing pharmacists or anybody who's on the ground, busy every day, is they don't need leadership that requires them to do much extra when they are absolutely at capacity and beyond. What the profession has given me as CEO in the past 20 months is a wave of professionalism and diligence for the communities that is unarguable. So I feel really empowered. I was at a business conference on behalf of the profession, Building Back Better, the ICTWW, and the aeronautical business, the hospitality businesses, with WHO there, were talking about what's needed now to come out of the profession, to come out of the pandemic. And I was there talking about the role that pharmacists had played in the pandemic and what was needed. And I was saying that you need to, across the board, whatever industry, if there's another pandemic, you need to involve everybody right from the start. The big ships, the big players, the corporates, the big multiples in all senses, and the little boats, the ones that can mobilise and run very quickly. And in our profession, we do that masterfully. So it's no stress for me to use the crest of the wave of everything our profession has been doing, alongside the fact that they've been doing it with disinvestment, and that is a global phenomenon. In no country really is community pharmacy seen as integral to the health service. It's always an add-on service, and we need to get ministries to understand the value of that, that it's exactly the same way as family physicians work, but we do that by investing in the medicines that patients and the public need. That's the first point, Jonathan. So it's actually easy to lead when the profession is leading day by day by day on the ground. And I view that as a professional privilege. Secondly, when it was 25th of October 2018, I'd started in my post in June, and we noticed that the Astana meeting was being held in Kazakhstan. And this was a renewal of the Alma-Ata declaration about primary health care. Prevention agendas, self-care agendas, the whole infrastructure in all of our global health had been implemented in 1978, and progress had been great. Maternal health had improved, infant health had improved globally, mortality rates were, or living life expectancies had grown everywhere. But actually, morbidity was growing, and with an aging population, it wasn't that aging people were living better. So Astana was set up to kind of renew and refresh the need for primary healthcare. Now note, Jonathan, I'm saying primary healthcare. It's a global term. It's not only primary care. It's not only physicians first. It's about everybody stepping up to deliver in the primary healthcare agenda. And that also includes those who work in secondary care. This isn't sector-based. It's about the place where you get your primary healthcare and the place where you go back and live when you have had an acute admission. So we signed pharmacy up for that. And then we signed ourselves up for that and said, agreed that we would focus on three big areas of work: pharmacist roles in NCDs, the five NCDs from the UN, but also the multiple NCDs that pharmacists handle routinely without even a blink or a shrug. So they are, the five are respiratory disease, cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and mental health. Mental health was added in 2019, and thank God they added that for the priorities, because mental health in our communities is a massive issue now post-COVID. So we have made a commitment that we will measure the impact of pharmacy on NCDs, prevention, which includes vaccination and self-care, and the safety agenda. Those three areas across the six regions, we will measure the impact very simplistically, and we will demonstrate that at each regional level, at each national level by 2023. We'll host a health minister summit then and show the value of pharmacy. In the interim, we'll just show the value of pharmacy on a bespoke level. And it's not, Jonathan, it's not just about doing more services for more patients. It's also about the sustainability of the services. And we mentioned, the third point I want to mention is, we mentioned the pandemic, but actually coming out of the pandemic, the biggest issue for all of us is managing the unmet need that has accumulated through the pandemic in all our societies, that big iceberg. For that, you need sustainable services. For that, you need adequate remuneration. For that, you need ample reward. And that's the big thing. We've got 21 development goals, Jonathan. The three prime ones are access, equity, and sustainability. And the sustainability goal, goal number 21 of the 21, is all around how we can ensure safe continuity of services across all of our regions. And you know what? In pharmacy, what unites us and what is similar is always greater than what divides us. So a pharmacist in Honduras will be having the same kind of challenges, broadly speaking, as a pharmacist in the Highlands. And that's what intrigues me. That's what really makes a job of a CEO of a global federation more doable. So you look for key themes. All ministers want to see is evidence of impact, the return on investment, and what's it going to cost us. And if we can provide all of that and show that it's value for money and show that we are stepping up to the primary healthcare agenda and showing that pharmacists are dealing with that big iceberg of unmet need, that's a model changer. Of course, we have to convince ministers, but that's our job.
I think, again, fascinating answer. I think a lot of the things you discussed there demonstrate your impact. But the last thing you said there was quite interesting. And there's been a bit of a theme emerging at our conference around, how would I put it? Like, pharmacists have sometimes, in various sectors, have been guilty of fixing problems no one cares about. And there's something around, for me, there's something around whether it's the minister that you're the person you're trying to influence, or whether it's it's the right thing to do for the patients. I think pharmacists on the ground, need to think about, is this activity or service or interpretation of pharmaceutical care right for my community? Or am I just doing it for another reason? And that might just be my own reputation, selfishly. It might be my career. It might be commercial reasons. I don't know. I know what your answer is, so I'm not going to ask you, but I wonder, is there a bit of a reprofessionalization to happen and maybe a bit more professional confidence? I don't know, but your answer is really interesting. I was going to say, this is going to, like, I'm going to fail on this, but because you are very diplomatic, but I'm going to test your diplomacy here. So of interest to me is, like, and one of the big learns potentially from the pandemic is understanding which countries or which pharmacy systems in which countries were best positioned to deal with what was to come. So I'm thinking, obviously in the UK, the community network and others stayed open. I know that's a highly politicized phrase now, but they did, to be honest. So that was phase one. But moving into phase two, there was the mass vaccination, and off the back of this, it's looking like there's going to be more preventative and forward thinking healthcare solutions delivered. So with all that in mind, in your view, which country was the best prepared for the pandemic, and in pharmacy terms, and why?
It's very interesting, Jonathan, and we've been asked as a profession to contribute to a piece of work that's leading to a World Health Summit at the end of the month, and being led by the Economist Intelligence. And they've been doing country case studies, based on what I would say perhaps about 6 months ago looked like success in some countries and then looked like failures in others on a big macro level. And then we've been asked to really plot what was pharmacy doing in those countries. I would say that some of the countries that looked like they were doing super well are now facing different challenges, and that includes Australia and New Zealand, for example. Some countries that did really well at the beginning had a bit of a hump in the middle, and that might include South Korea and Taiwan. What you can take as a key theme is you need an adequate workforce. You need the pharmacists and the pharmacy teams to be incorporated right from the very beginning. There needs to be central investment in good, what you might call protective equipment, that also trickles down. That's been a big gap in many countries. So I'm kind of giving you, I'm not telling you which is the best country, but I'm kind of telling you what has made a good country right from the start. And then in 2016, Jonathan, we had 16 countries where pharmacists were able to vaccinate. By the beginning of 2020, I think that was up to about 21, and now it's heading towards 60. We have some countries where pharmacists just won't be able to vaccinate, and then we have to think about, because they have, set legislation and it's not within the role of the pharmacist in that country. But then what can pharmacists do in the vaccination agenda? And where we see huge success is where pharmacists now are being empowered to take kind of a leadership role around life course immunisation, or perhaps, a calendarisation of immunisation programmes for pneumococcal disease, for influenza, for COVID, for this, for this, for this, so that there's almost like, it's this month, so you're going to do this. And I hesitate to say spring, summer, autumn, winter, because we work with northern and southern hemispheres and those turn on their heads. Having the pharmacist profession absolutely empowered to take part of the vaccination agenda is a huge, big issue. As I say, it's not going to be doable everywhere. So we want to double the number of countries that have pharmacists vaccinating very, very soon. And for that, Jonathan, the railback of regulations and legislations that we saw in so many countries, the US led in this, basically just stopped the regulation burden and empowered pharmacists of all cadres to be able to take part in this. You have to be able now to look at the legislation and regulations you put back in. We cannot go all the way back to pre-pandemic. So for me, it's about pharmacists being seen as part of the system and invested in terms of protection, were we to have another pandemic, in terms of workforce capability and numbers of workforce. Is there ways you can recruit from communities to support your assistant staff, for example, in an emergency situation? And the third thing then is mobilisation around vaccinations in whatever role is possible, with the appropriate relaxation of legislation and regulation. That made a country, whatever that country's name is, a success or more successful. And I would say that's for the community profession, but the same would apply to hospitals and the other sectors as well. I think it's just about pharmacy in a country being seen as central to the solution. And the moment you have that, then they're part of all of the initiatives that the rest of the health service is implementing. I would say, Jonathan, it's not about whether you've got public sector investment or you've got an insurance model or you've got a private sector model. That has not influenced the success of a country. It's about governments owning this and pharmacists being seen as central to that.
It's, again, really interesting. I think there's a lot. I mean, obviously the global picture is diverse and complicated and clearly fast moving. I mean, the number of countries that have come on board with vaccination that weren't previously is phenomenal. And speaking to what you said at the start of this sort of chat, that is a huge opportunity, isn't it? You know, there's clearly many thousands of pharmacists that are now touching patients and, you know, assessing them to a degree. I mean, I think my own view is that, you know, vaccination is really good, and I think pharmacists should be doing it. But it's, to be honest, it's largely a technical task. I see it as a stepping stone. And shameless plug, some of the work we're doing is trying to, you know, look forward to when every pharmacist becomes a prescriber in this country. Look at how we, well, the term we're using is micro-credentialing. So look at how we micro-credential the individual, you know, for a task, and actually in community pharmacy for a profitable task as well. I think that's okay. Not all the money comes from government or other bodies. Some of it has to stand on its own 2 feet. We need to build business models around it, in my view. But what impact, I mean, speaking about the UK, I mean, you've done loads of work over the years on, you know, you're involved in faculty, we've spoken previously about your, you know, your PhD around, all around pharmacists being, you know, procrastinating perfectionists, and, you know, building on that work of Zoom and Austin and stuff like that. But what do you see how do you see the whole, you know, every pharmacist becoming a prescriber playing out?
The thing is, Jonathan, that we have to make this make sense for the individuals on the ground. And sometimes lots of these initiatives can look like a very non-joined up set of canapes in front of you, and you're not sure how it all fits together to make a really lovely, sustainable, substantial meal, to use an analogy. So if somebody could see that they were building their portfolio of skills, some of them are difficult, some of them are easy to attain, and that they could gain a recognition for that, and that in combination, those skills, those attainments would add up to something more, I think there's an incentive for an individual. A lot of the things that we ask pharmacists to do around vaccination are a collation of very operational and very simple skills in individual in individual components, if you like. There's nothing difficult about it. It's the combination of that that makes it need a competence assessment, etc. And you need some form of recognition for that to demonstrate that you are a safe person to be vaccinating. The same thing, Jonathan, for if you're going to manage clinics for diabetic patients, or you're going to manage clinics for patients with respiratory disorders and those NCDs we were speaking about. You need some form of assessment and then badge, micro-credential that builds this for you. So you're investing in yourself, and then that enables an employer to describe what a role should be, and your skills should match that role, or the gaps should be being accommodated in a professional development plan, and you should be rewarded for the skills you bring to that role. And that to an individual kind of makes sense. An employer should make it make sense, because you're going to get returns on investment in that individual, and the clinics and the services they run will have to be the part of that return on investment, as you say, the business case. And that makes sense. And if you've got a service need in a community, you know, when we look at our GPs, they're very stretched at the moment, then beyond the dispensing of the items and the supply of the medicines, these services make sense. And if you can amass that one community to another, to another, to another, but based on the needs of that community, then you suddenly get a bit of a national picture or a regional picture of services based on needs, individuals with the appropriate credentials to be able to deliver those services with the appropriate remuneration that brings in the return on investment for the business. And of course, on paper, that's a virtuous infinity loop of good professional practice, good professional services, making good business sense. Unfortunately, a lot of the time, these are seen as separate, isolated things that you have to do, and an individual feels that they have to do it. So then, because I have to do it, what's the incentive for me to actually get on and do that? And who's the best body for me to do that with? And has anybody got a system that makes sense in entirety? Can I take that bundle of competence or that bundle of recognition with me as almost like my passport to practice? We've got a lot of COVID passport conversations at the moment. So it's my passport to practice. You know, could I take that to another country? Could I take that to a different region? Could I even take that to a different part of my community? Having that recognition, I think, is also a missing piece. So you don't have to go to the bottom of the ladder. And most of that, Jonathan, you and I have been talking about for many years. Most of that is needed for the profession to buy into that on an individual basis and on a business basis. The moment you have a workforce that can be seen as competent and able and fit to deliver new services, even if they're not that difficult, then you've got good business models. But the moment the profession can see it's of value to them as an individual, because you're doing good things with good intent for the people that you serve, you've got that virtuous loop, I would say.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I agree. We must find things we disagree on soon, Catherine, because folk will be getting bored with this. I totally agree. But to make that real, in a way, I agree. Like, I'll say this, but maybe you wouldn't. I don't think there should be a monopoly on who does that credentialing anymore. And the simple reason for that is not my life as a free marketeer, whatever, but it's more around the fact that there's going to be so many independent prescribing pharmacists in the UK and hopefully elsewhere shortly, in a very short time, that the governance, the competence, the capability, everything that builds supervision, you know, the reflective learning, case-based learning, all that stuff, you know, Viva interviews to check quality assured processes and all this kind of thing, that is all coming, and the volume of it is huge potentially. So it's more than one body, and I guess that's where we're positioning ourselves. I think people will be listening to this, and the, you know, the people that are attracted to conferences often, in my experience, are the, you know, either the political types or the high achievers, you know, and the early adopters. And there will be early adopters watching this and thinking, oh, that's really dull, you know, that I've done X, Y, and Z. I'm an independent prescriber, and I've prescribe X, Y, and Z complicated drugs, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But I suppose my ask of everyone is to sort of take a step back and think about I think I'm focusing on the you know, that pharmacist that has been a community pharmacist, maybe for years, a legacy pharmacist, supply function driven, done a cracking job, pillar of their community, but actually doing stuff like vaccination makes them quite nervous. Being a prescriber is frightening, you know, opening themselves up to that grey area. So, you know, that's, I guess that's where we're going with our, you know, this micro-credential thing. And I think, you know, sticking to initially to a very self-contained, we're going to do pneumococcal with these, with 60 independent prescribers, and, you know, sticking to a very self-contained clinical area is critical for us to just to build evidence and build confidence and competence. But where I was going to say to you, where it gets interesting, and I wondered if this is happening elsewhere in the world. So, you know, when we've got our, you know, our first cohort of micro-credentialed independent prescribing pharmacists through PIP, which will be great. The bit where it gets interesting for me is if, when, you know, they're prescribers, so they should be looking at the whole patient. You know, it's a patient-centered thing. So when that patient comes in and they get their pneumococcal vaccination or their flu, whatever, what else is going on? So, you know, is it the case that we need to do a micro-credential in, you know, doing a manual pulse check to check for AF for that 1 in 65 over 65s that have AF undiagnosed? Is it the middle-aged man that never presents for his hypertension opportunistic check as part of his cardiovascular risk assessment? So it's all that stuff. And then there's a conversation as well to be had around, is it okay to kind of build a business model around that? So is it okay to charge a fiver for that manual pulse check? I don't know. Is there anything like that happening elsewhere in the world, Catherine? And can that inform our activity in the UK?
So yes, there is. There's lots of examples, Jonathan, and I think they come from various different starting points and various different initiatives. We should remember that our ministers are having to come to terms with the fact that health needs a lot of investment. And I think the disinvestment we've seen, especially around areas seen not to be integral to health delivery, has to now, I would say, take a bit of a U-turn. It might end up being a left turn or a right turn, but it eventually we need to rail back on that. But the point you're making is that what we see as a success in many countries, Netherlands, Finland, Italy, then let me just take you to Indonesia, Jordan, parts of India, the Americas, Ecuador. Then we see perhaps African countries, they have very different levels of needs and innovation. Absolutely common themes are when you are viewed as integral to the health service, then that individual patient becomes one of your caseload. And you should be able to not only manage an immunization with them, but a whole program of immunizations based on their needs. And then you also need to be able to manage the medicines around some of the NCDs they may be suffering with, or doing some preventative checks. As you just say, you know, you've got somebody with risk factors for AF, why wouldn't you do a check for that? And the remuneration model is flexed in different countries. And we could easily showcase and share not only what you're up to, but also where you could learn, maybe even gather together people from a similar background and run something like a round table or an event where others could learn from it as well, Jonathan. And your point here about singularity of one body doing, or one body having a monopoly to do all of this, is just not feasible. It's a bit like saying that community pharmacists from one employer should be the only ones who do a certain type of vaccination. You close off the access. The next point I just wanted to make was that in the UK, we should view these opportunities as privileges. And, you know, the ability to prescribe is something that others would bite your hand off for in other countries. So we have that. And then how can we ensure that someone who's mid-career or perhaps a long time in practice feels supported and enabled to do that as part of their own professional development? doesn't feel it's a burden or a stress or an anxiety inducing thing, but ensures their position in their communities. And that I don't think is down to the individual to find the motivation for. I think we should be selling that into the bigger picture. And my final point here is that when you still see all of these services as separate little pieces, it doesn't join up for somebody. So they don't necessarily see that patient in front of them as needing a bit of this and a bit of that. And also because we haven't had the business model for it, Jonathan, we don't know how much these services should be charged for. You run the risk of underselling it, undercharging for it, or doing it in a piecemeal way, rather than a visit to the pharmacy would cost the health service this and the patient that. That might be a model that might work in one country. And in other countries, it's fully costed in for the patient. We see excellent models in Portugal where they got remunerated from the government by doing these pilot projects. And the other thing is, Jonathan, we've got to ban the word pilot project from our lexicon. Talk about proof of concept, talk about innovation with evaluation, and you suddenly take the pilot or the risk. If it doesn't work, it's not going to be invested in. And that's a complete psychological, it's not even based on science, it's just a psychological shift for us.
And do you think there's a global, like, you know, when you think of all the pharmacists, you know, the many thousands of pharmacists that the FIP interacts with, I'm sure you've met amazing, loads of amazing people in all corners of the world. Do you think there's an appetite to move on from what we've traditionally done and take on the new challenges?
I do. We see it all the time. And I think a lot of our pharmacists have risen to the challenge that they were faced with in their local community during the pandemic. And they got really inventive, Jonathan. But a crisis can do that, can't it? You know, a crisis can mean that you literally just have to get on with what's in front of you, and you can make do and mend, and you can kind of rise to the challenge of that. The issue here is, as the pandemic, if you think of it like a tsunami, if you're at the top of the crest of the wave, you're going to be fine. But then as the waters recede, you start to see some of the impact of the tsunami, in our case, the pandemic. And what we're seeing is that pharmacists are quite fatigued and stressed to be able to keep that energy up to do the innovative, the inventive, the added extras every day without a deadline in sight. So that's where the infrastructure needs to be built. And that's where we need to be giving support and ensuring increased capacity. But we have got, you know, you're quite right, Jonathan, you know, very often awards, etc., are about shining lights, and then others feel like they can't shine their own light because they're too exhausted or they don't have the infrastructure. We've got examples where just out of nowhere, pharmacists have worked with other professions to deliver vaccinations in refugee camps. We have examples of where pharmacists would run domiciliary visits, but with loud hailers from the tops of their vehicles in streets so that they could deliver to the doorstep during the pandemic instead of going into people's homes. And then they would do the video calls, or they'd get their teams to do it, or they get, you know, all of their assistants. You'd get inventive stories about how drones could be used to help supply, and pharmacists invested in those mini drones that you see in the air so that they could deliver medicines to patients who were very inaccessible. You know, living in high-rise flats, etc., and the pharmacists couldn't get into them. So, of course, we see the innovation. Of course, we see the examples of invention. But that's not sustainable, Jonathan. That's not something I would say that you can continue to do for the rest of your professional career without the adequate investment or without support or without increased infrastructure. And I think that's probably where people can get very disillusioned. When the tide goes out, and you're left to see the devastation, you know. And also, let's not forget, Jonathan, that this pandemic hasn't just happened to the people and the patients that we serve, but it's happened to us as well. So we've all got our own fatigue around impact on your own family, impact on your own situation. And that's something that's come out loud and clear. We've got a lot of calls from individual pharmacists for whether it be chats to talk through stress and fatigue and mental health issues, all the way through to, you know, is resilience what we need in the profession? That R word that seeks to be very comforting, but actually can imply you've just got to be strong and put a stiff upper lip on it. It really has had an impact on the profession that if we're not careful, I think, Jonathan, we will alienate so many if we don't bring people with us with the appropriate vision and the appropriate. It only takes a small step to do some of these new additional services, which could be transformational for your community.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It is, and where there's change or, you know, disruption, there is always opportunity, isn't there? I guess you're right. It's how we navigate that and how ready we are. I mean, I think from what you said, I mean that those numbers around, you know, different countries with pharmacists expanding vaccination services. I mean, that in many ways the pandemic has shown that it can be done. I think there's a lot of precedents have been shattered. But you're right. I think a lot of people, myself included, are, and I'm sure it's the same for you, are really, really reassessing life and just thinking, you know, like, actually, you know, it's a UK example maybe, but actually, do I want to sit in the car for an hour every morning and evening traveling to an office in Aberdeen? Or do I want to, you know, go down the M4 and sit in a traffic jam every day to get into London? You know, I think a lot of people are really questioning that, but I suppose it's been lovely to speak to you because, you know, that we must remember there's lots of good stuff going on. There's lots of opportunities in pharmacy still. I'm still really glad I did pharmacy, and it's certainly given me a great career personally, and I know it has many others, but it's not easy. It's not easy out there at all. If you're a pharmacy owner, it's tough. If you're a locum, it's tough. If you're an employed pharmacist in various sectors, it's really tough. So I think with all this sort of, you know, my visionary thinking and our training stuff, and I'm sure you'll agree with some of your initiatives, we've got to be mindful that it is still really quite tough and things are changing lots all of the time. But anyway, to finish, you've been very generous with your time. We always talk too much. But to finish, so this is our first ever conference, and it's exciting, but it would be more exciting if it was face to face. And you know, hopefully next year, I'll manage to shoehorn pharmacy and practice into the Scottish pharmacy calendar, and we'll do a face to face conference, and maybe you come along. But in the spirit of addressing the brief for a moment, and to finish, what would be your, well, you've answered it, I suppose. I'm not going to ask you that because you've answered what your vision is, but how do you see pharmacy changing? Like, are there any key things in the profession that you see just about to change or will change for the better within, you know, let's say in 20 years? What will be different?
So the thing I think, Jonathan, that you have to do when you're a leader is to paint the picture of the future. So in 20 years' time, if you think about the big global challenges we have, in 2019, they were described as a flu pandemic and air pollution and HIV and dengue fever and. So we've got to keep our societies living well for longer. That's a role for a pharmacist if we're central to patient care. It's no life at all to get to 80 years of age and not be able to have your faculties or be able to get out and about too much. So living well for longer. We've got to get this climate and the whole environment in which we live in a better position. And that includes the impact of air pollution on our populations as well as water pollution. And pharmacists have a huge role in both of those. I wouldn't say we've got a huge role in air pollution other than we've got to manage the patients who are impacted by it. But in water pollution, the profession has a big job to do in terms of toxicity from medicines in our waters, etc. So having a bit of a global perspective on where we're headed and then what can we do individually is not just something we're hearing from COP26, but it's also for us in our professional roles. And imagine if you have a pharmacist who has a case base and they work with that case base and they're able to triage those patients in and out of care and specialist care, and they are autonomous practitioners who are able to manage those patients without thought of a PID or patient group directive or a SOP, but with the fact that they are a qualified, credentialed individual who is able to manage those cases. And they can do part of that online and part of that, whatever the technology of 20 years will be. I would hate to be the one to predict that, because 20 years ago, we didn't have the tech that we're looking into now, Jonathan, and here we are.
I know.
But in order for us to paint that picture, you're so right to call today the future global pharmacist. You can't deliver in 20 years without starting today. And I just want to give a note of reassurance that we all live on this globe. And despite the politics of recent years being very divisive and becoming very insular in many of our lives, we've got to think of ourselves as global citizens. And in our professional lives, we are global pharmacists. We need to enable our profession to be able to be recognised wherever we want to work. And I mean, whichever country or whichever mode we want to work under, whether that be digital, virtual, with automation, you know, with all the tech that we need, but to serve the patients that need our care. One thing's for certain, as patients grow older, they need more care and more medicine. So that's, you know, there will be pharmacists wherever that is, unless we don't advocate for ourselves. And most of this is about evidence, impact and advocacy. And Jonathan, we can all do that, but you also need to demand of your leaders in the profession to do that on your behalf while you're getting on with the patient-facing role. My one final point is, it's not about being a future global pharmacist. Let's be a global pharmacist today. Let's think about the impact we're having on our lives, the patients we serve, our communities, and understanding that from a global perspective, I need that evidence of impact to be able to advocate at a global level, and you need that evidence of impact to be able to advocate at a community level. It's all the same thing. It's just that we do it to different audiences. And if we do it to enough audiences, Jonathan, the noise, the clamour, the evidence, the cold hard facts will be unshakable, undeniable. And then in 20 years, we can look back and think, we started that 20 years ago. And that's why we're here today in the rightful roles that our profession is commanding, with the rightful respect and the rightful remuneration and the rightful position of privilege in our communities. That's what I would say. It's not being a future global pharmacist, I'll leave that to next year. Let's be it today, let's be it now. And having that community, that ability to talk through these medias as well as face-to-face, Jonathan, wouldn't that be lovely? On a global level is something I would commend to everybody. When you talk to your pharmacists in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in Honduras, in Nigeria, and you find that you have this common thread of collegiality, it warms your heart. And sometimes we need that in these times of cold, hard reality coming out of this pandemic, if indeed we are coming out and we're not just entering a new phase. Jonathan, thank you so much for today. I've loved it. And I hope to see you all next year in a face-to-face capacity. And I hope that we could run a little mini satellite at our FIP Congress as well.
Lovely. Again, lovely way to finish, Catherine, but I mean, very annoying. I totally agree with everything you said. The only thing I would finish by saying is that you're not the only pharmacist in this conference to have said that the profession needs to find that golden thread of, I think you used the word collegiality, Rosemary Parr used to use that word as well, but that golden thread, because we are, at the end of the day, we're all pharmacists, you know. So yeah, thanks very much. It's been wonderful. And see you soon, hopefully. In the flesh, hopefully.
And if not, thank then we'll so make do with virtual until we can be together again, Jonathan. It's absolutely amazing. I hope your Congress goes really well and I hope everybody enjoys it. And I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Take care, Catherine. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.